This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome back to the second hour of the Financial Sense News Hour, The Big Picture. Jim Poplava is out this week. Speaking of being out, what would happen if the whole U.S. power grid went out? I mean, it could ruin your investments, not to mention almost everything else in society, especially if it stayed out for quite some time. And that, of course, is the danger of electromagnetic pulse, something one of America's enemies might set off, or a coronal mass ejection from the sun. They'd both have the same results. So what can we do about it? To examine that entire picture, here's Chris Sheridan and his guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry.
An electromagnetic pulse, also known as an EMP, is perhaps the greatest existential threat to North America and modern electronic civilizations everywhere, able to cause widespread destruction and cascading failures in the critical infrastructures we so heavily depend on today. That is the warning given by Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, who is the executive director of the Congressional EMP Commission, who joins us today. Dr. Pry, the first question I want to ask you is, are we heading toward an EMP catastrophe here in the U.S.?
Absolutely we are. It's as real as the sun rising up in the morning and as near to us as two North Korean satellites that are currently orbiting over our nation at the optimum altitude to do a nuclear EMP attack.
Wow, that's frightening. Okay, so from what you're telling me, it sounds like the threat has actually increased in recent years, given that there are two satellites now orbiting in the right trajectory, I take it.
And it's also increasing for another reason. Every 10 years, the semiconductor revolution, the microelectronics revolution, continues on its pathway, on its progressive positive pathway, producing better and better electronics that can operate faster and faster and at lower and lower levels of energy. You know, this is one of the things that has accounted for the great prosperity and the revolutionary developments in electronics that have made our lives better and made our country wealthier and more prosperous. But while this is going on, the very technological revolution that is feeding our prosperity is also making us more vulnerable. Because as electronics get smaller and faster and operate on lower and lower energy levels, they also become proportionately more vulnerable to EMP. So you have both of these things happening. Bad guys are getting nuclear weapons and more capabilities to inflict EMP attacks. Mother Nature, we haven't talked about that yet, but the sun can cause an EMP catastrophe as well. And we are overdue for a geomagnetic storm for the sun. So the likelihood of that increases with every day that passes. And our vulnerability is increasing because the critical infrastructures upon which we depend for our prosperity and survival, as they actually improve, they are also simultaneously becoming more and more vulnerable to this kind of attack. To give you an example, when the nuclear EMP phenomena was discovered by the United States in 1962 during the Starfish Prime event, you know, the electronics of the day were basically vacuum tube technologies. Those technologies were over 10 million times less vulnerable, 10 million times less vulnerable than the modern electronics that we depend upon today.
So that was actually something you mentioned in your recent presentation to the Canadian Parliament. So in 1961 and 62, just to set the background, the USSR had conducted several tests in Kazakhstan above their territory. And you write that they deliberately destroyed the electric grid and other critical infrastructures over an area larger than Western Europe. So this is a very large area. And I think, as you just said, the U.S. Congressional EMP Commission had sort of simulated that same exact threat or situation here in today's environment. And given today's electronic infrastructure, we were 1 million times more vulnerable than that of the 1960s experiment conducted by the USSR.
Yes, that's right. And before the EMP Commission, of course, you know, we were just the last ones to examine EMP vulnerability. The data is most current from the work the EMP Commission did using simulators. But the United States accidentally stumbled across the nuclear EMP phenomena during the Starfish Prime test over Johnston Island in 1962, you know, the Hawaiian Islands, where we did an experiment. We didn't know it was going to generate an EMP. We didn't even know what that was at the time. You know, we knew that the Russians had been doing funny things, detonating nuclear weapons at high altitude out in outer space. And we didn't understand why they were doing that, you know, because there are no blast effects, there's no radioactive fallout, there's no radiation. there wasn't anything we could see that the Russian tests were doing that would cause damage on the ground. So we conducted a high-altitude test of our own over Johnston Island, detonated a weapon out in outer space, and the Hawaiian Islands, which, as it turned out later, were just on the edge of the EMP field. You know, there was damage done to telecommunication systems, burglar alarms, cars, street lights that were knocked out, and we didn't know why. But then later we figured out it was the EMP phenomena. And in fact, the chairman of the Congressional EMP Commission, I was in kindergarten at the time when Starfish Prime happened, or in elementary school anyway. But Dr. Graham, who was the chairman of the EMP Commission, his first job as a young defense scientist working for the Department of Defense, they sent him out to Hawaii to figure out why did the lights go out. So the guy that I worked for and who has been the chairman of our commission, you know, was present at the discovery. I mean, he's the free world's foremost expert.
Dr. Pry, before we move on to some of the implications and what can be done to mitigate this risk, would you mind telling us a little bit more about the two main sources of an electromagnetic pulse? And you did cite them already. There's the man-made and there's the natural. Would you mind going into those a little bit?
Sure, not at all. If you can understand how a lawnmower starts, you can understand electromagnetic pulse. Basically, an EMP is caused, you know, by a moving magnetic field. A magnetic field, when it's in motion, will generate a current in a wire. That's basically all an EMP is. It's a moving magnetic field that generates a current in a wire. So when you go to start your lawnmower and you pull on the cord on your lawnmower, what you're doing is you're spinning a magneto, which is a cluster of magnets, and you're creating a moving magnetic field inside your lawnmower. And that magneto is surrounded by a coil, which is a bunch of wires, and the moving magnetic field causes a current to form in the wires, and it creates a tiny electromagnetic pulse that you can see it as a spark in the spark plug. Now, the Earth is a giant magnet. Let's talk about natural EMP first, because it's the easiest thing to understand. So the Earth is a giant magnet, and it's got a north and a south pole, and it's surrounded by a magnetic field called the magnetosphere. And every now and then, the sun will hurl a chunk of itself out into space called a coronal mass ejection. It's a big blob of ionized plasma, and it comes out of the sunspots like an electromagnetic cannon almost. And this big chunk of plasma will go through space. Most of the time, these coronal mass ejections miss the Earth, but every now and then, they will hit the Earth. And the thing that keeps us from being burned to the crisp is the magnetosphere, which keeps blob that is at very high temperatures reaching the surface of the Earth. But in the process of protecting us, the magnetosphere gets distorted, and it wobbles around and moves around. And as a consequence, you have a natural EMP that's called a geomagnetic storm. And these happen all the time. They happen every year. They usually don't affect nations at our latitude. Normally, they affect countries at high northern latitudes around the North Pole, like Sweden or Russia or Norway. And it will typically cause problems with communications, with the power grid. Air traffic is usually redirected away from the North Pole regions when a geomagnetic storm is going on. Now, those countries that are exposed to those things have learned to cope with them. That's not what we're really worried about, not a normal run-of-the-mill geomagnetic storm. A more powerful geomagnetic storm, as an example, happened in 1989. It was called the Hydro-Quebec storm, and it blacked out half of Canada, you know, for about a day. It caused billions of dollars of losses, and a few lives were probably lost as a result of that. But even that is not what we're concerned about. What we're concerned about is the once-in-a-century super geomagnetic storm, like the 1859 Carrington event, which is the most powerful geomagnetic storm on record, which would be about 100 times more powerful than the 1989 Hydro-Quebec storm. And when what happens here is that you get a coronal mass ejection that has so much energy in it, it's so big, and it's moving so fast. And by the way, the normal velocity for coronal mass ejection that causes these normal storms is like 1,000,000 miles an hour. The coronal mass ejection will travel at 1,000,000,000 miles an hour. But a Carrington-class coronal mass ejection will travel much faster than that, 3 times faster, and is much bigger, many times the size of the Earth. And when one of those things comes slamming into the Earth, well, you've scaled things up now, you know, from the level of a lawnmower to a planetary level. And so you're talking about enormous field strengths that will be generated by the disturbance that is inflicted on the magnetosphere by a collision with this huge coronal mass ejection that is many times the size of the Earth and that is moving 3,000,000 miles an hour. And again, the coronal mass ejection, this blob of ionized plasma, doesn't reach the surface of the Earth, but it will cause a natural EMP everywhere on the Earth, not just in the northern hemisphere, everywhere on the Earth, the way the Carrington event did. You know, we know from 1859 that as a consequence of that geomagnetic superstorm, even though it was not an electronic civilization, they did have telegraph system. That was the primitive electronics of the day that were much more robust than our modern electronics, as you can imagine. Telegraph lines just burst into flame. There were forest fires all over the world because telegraphs existed in India, China, and Africa that had been put up. We just laid the transatlantic cable in 1859. The natural EMP from the Harrington event, you know, was so powerful that it reached miles deep into the Atlantic Ocean and burned out the transatlantic cable that had been laid. And they had to send the Great Eastern out there to relay that transatlantic cable. And that's what we're most concerned about happening, because we're overdue for one of these. The EMP Commission calculated that a Carrington-class geomagnetic superstorm happens about once a century. And you don't have to be an astrophysicist to know that 1859 was more than a century ago, all right? So 1859 to 1959, so we're well overdue for experiencing one of these things. We now know, because we've put up satellites so we can watch these coronal mass ejections. We've actually had some close calls. There was a Carrington-class geomagnetic coronal mass ejection, July 25th, 2012. You know, just a few years ago, that just missed the Earth by 3 days. You know, if the Earth had been 3 days earlier, if it had come along 3 days earlier, it would have hit us dead on, and we would have had this catastrophe that I'm describing. Maybe I should describe the catastrophe in more detail, because what happens with this natural EMP is it causes power grids to collapse and be destroyed, and these are not temporary blackouts. You know, it will burn out generators, burn out extra high voltage transformers, things that take months or years to replace. And so you're talking about a protracted blackout from which you might never recover, because it becomes a race between, you know, we are electronic civilizations and everything, business, finance, food and water, communications, transportation, all the things that sustain life depend directly or indirectly on the electric grid and electrical system and electricity. And when that's taken away, our ability to sustain the population of the planet is also taken away. You know, billions of lives would be put at risk. The commission estimated that if we had a nationwide blackout in North America that lasted 12 months, 1 year, up to 90% of our population would probably perish from starvation, disease, and societal collapse. And if you lose 90% of your population, there's probably no coming back from that. So that's the kind of scale of catastrophe, what we call an existential threat, that is posed by natural EMP and also by nuclear EMP. And you know, the nuclear EMP is, in some respects, even worse, you know, because while a nuclear EMP attack would not cover the whole planet, the EMP field that you'd get from a nuclear weapon detonated at high altitude would be able to cover a continent, for example, all 48 contiguous United States. Those North Korean satellites, for example, the KS-4, North Korea just launched on February 7th. You know, it flies at an altitude over us, you know, that is for a nuclear weapon. If there's a nuclear weapon in that satellite and they detonated it over the center of the United States, it would create an EMP field that would cover all 48 of the contiguous United States, most of Canada and large parts of Mexico, and destroy electronics all within the circle of that EMP field. And as I said, although the extent of the EMP field would not be as great as from a geomagnetic superstorm, it would be worse in the respect that a nuclear EMP attack, in addition to doing what the geomagnetic superstorm does, it produces another kind of an EMP that we call E1 EMP, which is a very high-frequency electromagnetic pulse, and it can go up to, in the case of a super EMP weapon, 200,000 volts per meter, and it can penetrate and enter small electronics. The natural EMP for the sun affects big things. It has to have a target that's like a kilometer or larger, and so it will hook into power grids, telecommunication systems, railroad tracks, pipelines, and find its way indirectly into electronic systems that way to destroy them. The nuclear EMP attack, in addition to doing that, will also directly couple into like the personal computer on your desk and electronics of that size and automobiles, you know, and cause them paralyzed right directly into airliners. There's probably about 500,000 people in the air as we speak every day. You know, there's over 1,000 airliners carrying about 500,000 people through the skies. And a super EMP weapon detonated over America would probably cause most or all of them to fall out of the skies and crash on the ground. You know, nuclear reactors would go Fukushima, you know, because we know what happens when the electric grid goes down and they have to rely on their emergency generators and then their batteries. You know, they run out of fuel for the emergency generators in about 3 days and then the batteries are exhausted. So 7 days after an EMP event, you know, over 100 nuclear reactors in the United States would go go Fukushima, you'd have radioactivity being carried by the winds and the weather covering most of the country. Those nuclear reactors are co-located with their population centers.
It sounds like an EMP is absolute worst-case scenario for civilization in that case. I don't think that there's much other that we could point to except for perhaps an asteroid hitting the Earth. I mean, is that the scale of devastation we're looking at?
Yes, it is. And the thing that makes it worse than an asteroid is that only Mother Nature can do an asteroid, you know? In this case, we have to worry about man. In addition to Mother Nature that can pose this kind of threat, we have to worry about man being able to pose this kind of threat. And one of the things that makes it worse than other man-made kinds of threats is that it's relatively easy for man to do it. You know, you don't need a high-yield, sophisticated nuclear weapon. Any nuclear weapon will do. The super EMP weapon I described is basically a simple technology that's been illegally trafficked for a long time. It's like a low-yield hydrogen bomb. It's like what we used to call a neutron bomb. The official name for that is enhanced radiation weapon. You know, it's a technology that goes back to the 1950s. You know, when we finally weaponized that technology in the 1980s under the Carter administration, you know, we were able to make it so that it could be fired out of a nuclear artillery. There was a nuclear artillery shell that was an enhanced radiation weapon, and it weighed less than 100 pounds. You know, so you could put something like that on a satellite, one of these North Korean satellites. You know, we believe North Korea has got this technology, you know, because it's well within their grasp. And not only that, but we were told by Russian generals who are their top EMP experts that the technology for their super EMP weapon had, quote unquote, accidentally leaked North Korea. The North Koreans, what they've done with their satellites, and they appear to have exercised and practiced EMP attacks. And you don't even need a nuclear weapon. There's a third kind of the threat that I described in my Canadian testimony that often gets overlooked, because there are non-nuclear EMP weapons called radio frequency weapons. And you can actually build these out of parts that you could buy from an electronics store. Or if you have no gift for electronics, you can actually buy them. And it's not intended to be used as a weapon. But as an example, in one of my books, in my book Blackout Wars, I have a picture of one of these devices. It's advertised called an EMP suitcase. And it looks just like a suitcase, and it's not intended to be used as a weapon. It's sold by an American company. They are called EMP simulators. They're used as a diagnostic tool in industry. If you're laying out the floor plan for a plant that's going to have large electronic equipment in it, the equipment puts out electromagnetic transients, and you have to space the equipment far enough apart or put barriers in between the machines so they don't destroy each other. And what this is intended to do is enable you to plan out the floor plan, as an example, for what your industrial facility should look like. How far apart should machines be? How thick do the walls have to be to shield the machines from each other? It's not intended to be used as a weapon. It's intended for this peaceful purpose. And I doubt the manufacturer, it ever occurred to him that terrorists could just buy this thing and put it in the trunk of a car and drive it out to a big transformer substation outside of a major metropolitan area. And basically, we've arrived at a place where our technology is so advanced that a single individual, a madman or a terrorist who got his hands on the EMP suitcase, for example, could topple the technological pillars of civilization for a major metropolitan area. And more than that, if you did have a terrorist team and they had nine of these, you know, there's 2,000 extra high voltage transformer substations in this country. They are to our civilization what roads and aqueducts used to be to the Roman Empire, to classical civilization. You know, our electronic civilization cannot work without these big transformer substations. And although there's 2,000 of them, there are nine of them that are absolutely critical. And if the bad guys knew which nine to attack, you know, they could take nine of these suitcases and bring them to that and black out the country for 18 months. And that's what was estimated by the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And as I said before, even if the blackout lasted a year, we'd lose 90% of our population. So these are the three threats. From nature, an EMP from the sun in the form of a geomagnetic superstorm. Nuclear EMP, you know, or a single nuclear weapon of any kind, really. But the worst kind would be the super EMP weapon, but any kind. Even a crude first-generation atomic weapon generates gamma rays and will produce an EMP that would have catastrophic consequences for our society. And then the non-nuclear EMP weapons, things like this EMP suitcase. By the way, which you don't even need a license to buy it. You need a license to buy a pistol. You need a license to drive a car. I mean, the manufacturers don't know it, but in effect, they're marketing a weapon of mass destruction, and you don't even need a license to buy it.
That's amazing. So the threat is clearly real. This is not science fiction. There have been numerous studies of which you have taken a part of and that you have been discussing throughout the world, I believe. As you just noted, you just recently returned from giving a testimony to the Canadian Parliament about the threat of EMPs. So with that said, what are some of the things that can be done either by governments or private corporations, you know, companies that are involved in maintaining the critical infrastructure that we use today to mitigate these risks?
Well, this is why I've decided to dedicate what's left of my professional life to trying to protect our civilization from this threat. Because in addition to being the greatest threat we face, the easiest one for the bad guys to impose against us, and a threat that is inevitable, you know, because sooner or later we are going to get hit by a geomagnetic superstorm. NASA estimates the likelihood is 12% per decade that we will experience a geomagnetic superstorm. That guarantees that within our lifetimes or that of our children, you know, this phenomenon will happen. And yet there's no excuse. There's no excuse because we know how to protect against this. It doesn't cost a lot of money. The Department of Defense has been doing it for 50 years. We've been protecting our military systems for 50 years using the technology of Faraday cages and blocking devices and surge arresters. And there are new technologies coming online all the time that can do it better and less expensively. You take the example of the electric grid. You know, when the EMP Commission delivered its report in 2008, it included a plan on how to protect the electric grid. You know, we can put blocking devices and surge arresters on those 2,000 EHV transformers to protect them against the EMP. We can put SCADAs, the Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition System. These are the little computers that run not just the electric grid, but all the critical infrastructures. They run the way natural gas flows through a pipeline. They run the way water flows through a pipeline. They run the way the traffic lights work and the way the air traffic control systems work and locomotive switching systems. You know, you can run a whole city with 12 people now because of the SCADA, you know, whereas before it used to take thousands of people to do that. But if EMP happens and it burns these things out, civilization comes to a grinding halt. But you can protect those SCADAs. They can be hardened against EMP. We actually took a look at the SCADA that runs all of these traffic control systems for the stoplights, air traffic control systems, railroad control systems, and diagnosed it. And we found that its vulnerability, there was a particular fuse in that system. There was already a fuse available on the market that just by accident of its design, you know, would make it hundreds of times less vulnerable to EMP if they just replaced that fuse. And it would have cost an extra nickel. It would cost about a nickel more to buy that fuse than the other fuse that was already being used. So the fix can sometimes be as simple as that, you know, just changing out the vulnerable part and replacing it with a part that's not going to be vulnerable. So there's really no excuse to be vulnerable. It's not the technology. We know we have the technology, and there's better technology coming online all the time. It's not the money. The commission estimated it would cost about $2 billion, with a B, $2 billion to protect the North American electric grid. Probably 10 to 20 billion to protect all of the critical infrastructures. But if you did nothing else but protected just the electric grid, that alone would be an enormous safety margin, you know, because we found you can probably recover pretty quickly all the other critical infrastructures as long as you don't go into a protracted blackout. If you lose the electric grid, since everything depends on electricity, I mean, you're basically dead. But if you at least just protect the electric grid for $2 billion, you can bring everything back pretty quickly and avoid mass starvation. $2 billion is what we give away in foreign aid every year to Pakistan. I mean, if we suspended foreign aid to Pakistan, you know, for 1 year and spent it on the security of the American people, you know, that would solve that problem. I don't even know why we give $2 billion a year to Pakistan, because they're a nuclear weapons state and they're not really friendly to the United States. They sheltered Osama bin Laden and basically don't like America very much. Yet we give them $2 billion a year, so go figure.
That really puts the figure in context right there.
Exactly. And there are other estimates because there are different plans. You know, you can spend a lot more than $2 billion and buy more security. You can spend a lot less than $2 billion, and that would greatly increase your security, but it wouldn't give you as much security as a $2 billion plan. The way to think about it is, you know, suppose you were trying to fireproof your house. You wanted to protect your family against fire. And right now you had no protection in your house at all against fire. All right? By the simple act of spending $20 and putting a smoke alarm in your house, you know, if you look at the knee in the curve in terms of how much security you're buying, that's an enormous increase in your security. When you go from zero preparedness and you just spend $20 on a smoke alarm, you know, you will find that the statistics are that you greatly increase the likelihood of your family surviving a fire. But you can spend more money and do more, and maybe you should. You know, you can buy a fire extinguisher to have in the kitchen, which is where fires most likely buy out. You can go whole hog and put sprinklers in every room of your house. That's going to be a lot more expensive, but it also greatly increases your security. You know, not only will your family assuredly be saved, but you'll save your house from burning down too. So it's sort of like that. You know, it depends upon how much security you want to buy. But the commission recommended, you know, the $2 billion plan for the electric grid. And it's a good, solid plan.
Well, Dr. Pry, I think that brings up a good question in terms of what individuals can actually do. Because let's just assume that our U.S. government does not invest the necessary $2 billion to protect our North American electrical grid and make any other investments along those lines. And we are vulnerable to an EMP catastrophe, as you've warned. In that case, what could we as individuals do realistically? Is that just building Faraday cages, or are there other things that are more practical?
Well, yeah. Well, first let me speak. We are a democracy, and it is true that the U.S. government has, at the federal level, you know, has not acted to protect the electric grid. This is not for lack of trying. You know, every year, the Congress, on a bipartisan basis, and I'm surprised this doesn't make the news, because how often do you hear about Republicans and Democrats, 100% of them, joining behind any legislation these days, right? But it has happened almost every year. You know, the Republican Democrats have joined behind legislation. Originally, when the Democrats controlled the House of Representatives, it was called the Grid Act. Later, when the Republicans got it, it was called the Shield Act. But it was basically similar legislation to try to protect the national electric grid from EMP. And it would get 100% support in the House, and then go over to the Senate. But Washington has become so corrupt and so broken. I don't think the founders intended the system to work so that an individual senator could thwart the entire will of the House of Representatives by putting a hold on a bill and not even have to take responsibility for it. They can do that anonymously. They can put an anonymous hold on the bill. And that's what's happened for 8 years. The House would unanimously support passed legislation. It would go over to the Senate, and some one senator who to this day has not stepped forward to take responsibility would put a hold on that bill. So one guy over in the Senate has been keeping this country vulnerable to EMP. And it's because there's this huge lobbying group called the NERC, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. They're supposed to be concerned with the security of the grid. But in practice, what they are is a big lobbying industry for the 3,000 electric utilities who don't want any government regulation at all and don't want to be told to spend anything on anything. They exist in this 19th century regulatory environment. They want to keep it that way. But they're the ones that have been stopping progress on legislation. Now, last year, 2015, was different. We actually had a number of big successes. And, you know, they're losing the war, even though it's a David versus Goliath struggle, because on my side of the fence, I mean, there's a handful of scientists and intelligence officers and, you know, former CIA directors and things like that. And we're up against basically the whole electric power industry. So it's a real David versus Goliath struggle. But we've been winning that struggle. You know, we managed at the federal level, again, the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act now passed out of the House unanimously. And it's in the Senate. I think it very likely it's going to pass. The Congressional EMP Commission was reestablished. There's a bill that also passed out of the House called H.R. 8, the Energy Bill. And it has provisions in it for protecting the grid. So we're actually winning. Last year, after not winning anything, we suddenly had a string of big victories at the federal level. And this is guaranteed that it's going to happen. You know, the lobbyists have won before, but it's never looked better. So after 8 years of fighting, you know, it looks like we're on the verge of victory at the federal level. One thing people can and should do is call their senators and call their congressmen. Say, support these bills. Support the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act. Pass that bill now. Don't let the lobbyists win. Another thing they could do as individuals is ask their governors and their state legislatures to protect the electric grid within their state. Because the solution does not have to be, and maybe the best solution isn't, at the federal level. In the commission recommended that every individual state could launch its own initiative to protect the grid within its state, protect the transformers and the generators and the SCADAs within that state. It's called islanding. It doesn't change the way the grid works on a normal day-to-day basis. But if there's ever an EMP, the protective devices are there to stop the grid from going into blackout. And by the way, since EMP is the worst threat to the grid, it will protect against all the lesser threats. These technologies I'm talking about will also protect against the worst-case cyber threats. It'll protect against physical sabotage and severe weather as well. So if there's a hurricane or something like that, you'll be able to bring the grid back much more quickly instead of the situation we had with Hurricane Sandy, where thousands of people were homeless for weeks and weeks. And, you know, you'd be able to reverse that situation and people would be able to go back to their homes much sooner because the electricity would come on much sooner. So those are things people can do and get their governors and their state legislatures motivated to do this as well. My book, Blackout Wars, is actually a kind of a handbook because we've done this in Maine and Virginia and Florida and Arizona. And it started with one determined individual in each of those states. You know, people linked up with one determined state legislature, and it turned into a movement within each of those states, and those states are well on the way to protecting themselves from an EMP and from these other threats. Now, I know your question was focused on what individual families do, and there's a lot that you can do as individual families if you don't want to be politically active, though I would encourage everybody to be politically active as part of your survival strategy for your family. But the kind of preparedness you would engage in for any kind of a big natural disaster would be the same thing for EMP. You know, you want to make sure you've got a food supply. Make sure you have a water filter or water stored someplace so that you can have water. It might be a good excuse to have a swimming pool. You know, right there, if you even have a small swimming pool, that's 20,000 gallons of pure water that would be available to you. Have a medicine kit and know how to use it. Think about where you live. Is it safe there if you have societal breakdown? The kind of location you're at, is it likely that you would be subject to attack by gangs or criminals? If so, you know, you might want to have some kind of a plan. If you have relatives in the country who have a farm, friends in the country who have a farm, you might want to talk to those friends and all get together and have a plan for both of your families so that you can divide the labor and see what assets you bring to each other. In terms of protecting electronics, you know, you can turn your garage into a Faraday cage. A Faraday cage is just a big metal box with no windows. Even if it has windows, you could put chicken wire over the windows. It's not just metal that the EMP won't penetrate, but it won't go through wire mesh. So if you had a metal garage and the thickness of the walls has to be at least 1/8 of an inch, all right, and designed it like a Faraday cage, you could protect your car or anything else you put in that garage for an EMP. If you've got a member of your family who has some kind of an illness, and there's some kind of electronic medical equipment that you need, you might want to have spares of that and protect it by putting it in a Faraday cage. Like a metal garbage can with a tight-fitting lid can be used as a Faraday cage. You know, you just put whatever it is you want to protect in a plastic bag so it doesn't touch the metal insides of the garbage can. Put it in the can and put the lid on, and there you go. And that would protect it against an EMP. Get a siphon as part of your plan. And by the way, it's not true. There's one myth out there that modern vehicles cannot be protected from EMP and that you should have only in old cars that are before the microelectronics revolution, you know, pre-1970s. And that's not true. It is true that the fewer electronics you have in a car, the less vulnerable that car will be. But you could probably harden a modern car pretty easily. At an electronics store, there's these things called ferrite tubes. They use them to go over the wires to protect for your personal computers, to protect them from electromagnetic transients. You know, the pulse, it can't directly couple into a semiconductor. It's got to couple into a wire and then follow the wire to get to the semiconductor. So if you can protect the big wires in your car that might pick up an EMP by covering them with a ferrite tubes, you know, that would go a long way. Wouldn't be an absolute guarantee that the car would survive, but like putting a smoke alarm in your house, it would be an enormous step toward increasing the likelihood that that car would survive. Now, there's other things you can do to the car, but if you've got a mechanic, put ferrite tubes on the long wires in your car, the material cost of that would be less than $100. The mechanic's labor for 2 hours work, whatever that is, you know, the whole thing would probably cost about $150. And you'd have a car that would be much better, more likely, you know, to survive an EMP event. Have a siphon and know how to use it. One of the things I recommend for all communities, every fire department, police department, you know, ought to buy a hand siphon so that they can access the gasoline at gasoline stations because the gas pumps won't work after an EMP. But you'll have thousands and thousands of gallons of underground storage tanks. And if you had a plan in your community to ration that so the police and fire could use it and emergency teams at the hospitals, you know, a whole community could have a plan, you know, that would get them through an EMP. You know, that gasoline that's down in the storage tanks, if it was rationed, it could last years, potentially. So those are just some ideas about what people could do as individuals and as communities, you know, to get through an EMP catastrophe.
You mentioned that there's been a lot of support in this direction recently, and that we've seen some steps being taken by, you cited individual states that are now making attempts to harden their electric grids. And of course, the reestablishing of the Congressional EMP Commission, which you are the executive director of. Has the catalyst for this support or moves in this direction, has that catalyst been North Korea? What would you say is really responsible for bringing about some of these successes that you mentioned earlier?
I think the catalyst is the looming EMP threat and an increasing awareness by people that the electric grid is a major source of societal vulnerability that they didn't know about before. The close call that we had with the sun back in July of 2012 that I described earlier. You know, there have been real world cases of EMP actually being used in non-nuclear EMP weapons that I think have raised alarms too. North Korea, for example, they have an EMP cannon that they got from the Russians. It's basically a radio frequency cannon that's mounted on the back of a truck. They used that starting in 2010. They used it to impose what they call an electromagnetic blockade on Seoul, the capital of South Korea, for a period of a few weeks, you know, because this thing threatens airliners. You know, it threatens the GPS systems and airliners. It also caused thousands of automobiles to fail, so you couldn't start them in towns and villages within range of the cannon, you know, which is near the demilitarized zone. And they raised all kinds of other electronic hobs. So here's a country, you know, using non-nuclear EMP against airliners. At the time that it got into the news a lot, so that helped raise consciousness. I think the orbiting of these satellites, the first one, the KSM-3, was orbited in 2012. The Obama administration is certainly not like to talk about it. People know we're in the middle of this nuclear crisis with North Korea. But we had another nuclear crisis with North Korea. Up to that time, it was the most severe nuclear crisis we had ever experienced with North Korea. The aftermath of their illegal nuclear test in February of 2013, they had conducted their third illegal nuclear test. And as a consequence, the Obama administration got the United Nations to impose additional sanctions on North Korea. And Kim Jong-un, the new leader of North Korea, started making threats to make nuclear strikes on the United States and against our allies. And in response to that, the Obama administration, on one hand, seemed to take those threats seriously by beefing up the national missile defenses and flying B-2 bombers along the demilitarized zone. But at the other hand, the president, perhaps because he didn't want the public to panic, this is perhaps a benign interpretation, but for whatever reason, he basically misinformed the American people and said North Korea couldn't deliver on these nuclear threats. He claimed that they had not miniaturized a warhead that could reach the United States at that time. And to this day, the White House has continued to put that out there to try to diminish and lowball the North Korean threat. But it isn't true. You know, the Department of Defense has actually put out unclassified reports telling them about how the North Koreans have got at least a half a dozen ICBMs that have nuclear weapons called the KN-08. More recently, this wasn't back in 2012, but more recently, they've rolled out a new ICBM called the KN-14 that has an even longer range and can deliver a nuclear weapon against the United States. But to go back to 2012, when Obama was telling the American people that North Korea couldn't deliver on these nuclear threats, the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is the lead agency for assessing foreign threats, was briefing Congress that North Korea did have nuclear armed missiles and could deliver on these threats. And that leaked to the press. And the Obama administration engaged in denial behavior. They ran out General Clapper, who said, well, that's just the view of the DIA. There's like 12 other agencies in the intelligence community. But that was extremely misleading because they made it sound like the DIA was a minority view. They're the lead agency. What they think matters most. And the CIA agreed with them, by the way. In fact, all of the agencies that have any opinion on these matters have judged that North Korea's got nuclear armed missiles and has had them for years. The other agencies he's talking about are things like the Department of the Treasury. They're part of the intelligence community. The Department of Commerce has got a little group of people that are part of the intelligence community. The Secret Service is part of the intelligence community, but they have no expertise on nuclear weapons and nuclear missiles. So this was extremely misleading to try to imply that the DIA was some kind of minority view on this. Anyway, on the very day Obama gave an interview to the New York Times, on April 16th of that year, and on the very day that he was saying that, oh, they haven't miniaturized a weapon so that they could attack the United States, North Korea's KSM-3 passed right over Washington, D.C. on the very day he was saying that. I wrote about that. Others, Ambassador Henry Cooper, you know, one of our nation's foremost leaders in missile defenses. He was the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative, you know, wrote articles about that. The KSM-3 has never gone away. It continues to orbit over us at the optimum trajectory to evade our national missile defenses because it's on a south polar trajectory. Perhaps this is worth talking about in a little more detail. You know, during the Cold War, the Soviet Union developed a secret weapon called the Fractional Orbital Bombardment System. And what they plan to do is use a space launch vehicle so it looked like a non-threatening, peaceful thing to orbit a satellite that had a nuclear weapon in it. And before the big nuclear attack that they were planning to make a surprise nuclear attack against America, what they would do is they would launch the satellite. And because it's on the trajectory of a satellite and not on the ballistic trajectory that a nuclear weapon is going to take when it's going to go destroy a silo or attack a city or something like that, it's on an orbital trajectory, it would look non-threatening and would look even more non-threatening because it's being launched by a space launcher vehicle and it's going to the south, away from the United States. And then what it would do is it would go south, pass over the south polar region, and then come on the other side, approaching us from a southerly trajectory. And the reason for doing that is because we have no ballistic missile early warning radars facing south, and we have no missile interceptors facing south. We didn't in the Cold War, and we still don't today. We're blind and defenseless to the south. Then you'd fly this thing over and do an EMP attack. It would detonate, you know, at an altitude of 300, 400 kilometers, put that EMP field down over everything. And their hope was that it would fry our electronics and interfere with our command and control and interfere with our ability, the president's ability to pass emergency action messages onto our forces so that it would paralyze us long enough so that they would then launch their long-range missiles, their SS-18s, which would take 30 minutes to reach the United States. If they could keep us paralyzed for just 30 minutes, that would be enough for the ICBMs to complete their trajectories and reach our ICBM silos and our bombers on their bases and basically disarm us. It's called a nuclear disarming first strike, and thereby win a nuclear war. Anyway, this North Korean satellite, the KSM-3, it looks just like the old Soviet idea for the fractional orbital bombardment system. It's launched by a space launch vehicle. It's on a satellite that goes on this south polar trajectory. It passes over us from the south where we have no ballistic missile early warning radars and no means of intercepting us. It passes right over the optimum altitude and location over our country to put an EMP field over everything. And it's been doing that since 2012. And now it's been joined by a second North Korean satellite that does exactly the same thing. Now, North Korea doesn't say these things are nuclear weapons. It says they're Earth observation satellites. But we have no idea what's in these things. We also know they don't transmit any data. You know, if they're an Earth observation satellite, how come there's no data being transmitted out of these? And we also know that the first one, as I mentioned before, it made this appearance in the midst of this worst ever nuclear crisis we had with North Korea back in 2013. And now the second one has been launched on February 7th amidst this new nuclear crisis we've got with North Korea. So it looks to us like North Korea is either practicing a nuclear EMP attack by means of a satellite, or it might actually be positioning itself to make such an attack, you know, by having these satellites orbit over us. For all we know, I just published an article with Jim Woolsey, the former CIA director, and my co-authors in that article were Bill Graham, who had been President Reagan's science advisor, and Fritz Ehrmarth, who had been the chairman of the National Intelligence Council, and Ambassador Cooper, who I described. These are the great minds, you know, that were Ronald Reagan's brain trust and managed to win the Cold War without firing a shot. And these guys are all very concerned that there could be a nuclear weapon on those two North Korean satellites. We just published an article in the Washington Times about this on Monday. So that is a big concern for us. You know, they're either practicing it or maybe they're already positioned. And that's why I think it's one of the reasons I think this is the greatest threat to our civilization. It's not just a theoretical threat. We actually have satellites flying over our heads that could be that threat in the making, you know, as we speak.
Dr. Pry, perhaps I'm a cynic. I would say this is probably more of a realistic view, but it seems to me that governments are much more reactive than they are proactive, and that, you know, a lot of these preventative measures that could be taken in terms of hardening our electric grid and the $2 billion amount that was estimated in order to protect our own electric grid here in North America, you know, a lot of these different things that you'd mentioned that could be done are unlikely to be implemented unless the actual event occurs. Do you see that taking place? Is that kind of the fear that you see taking shape, or do you think people are taking this threat seriously and legitimately making some of these steps to mitigate the risk?
Historically, you're absolutely right. It is a great failing of democracies. They are usually too late to act. And I think it was Otto von Bismarck who said, "God looks after fools, little children, and the United States." And we have been fortunate in our history that God has looked after us, that we have failed to react in time. And only the thing itself has befallen us, a Pearl Harbor, for example. And only then do we act. My original training was as a historian, and I'm haunted by the history of the gathering storm years, as Churchill described them in his magisterial account of World War II. You know, those years just before World War II, I think we're in a similar situation. I think we're in the equivalent of that. Right now, we're going through our 1937, 1938, 1939 period, just before the outbreak of the war, when a handful of people like Winston Churchill and a few farsighted generals, you know, and military advisors who surrounded him saw that the Nazis had come up with a new way of warfare called the Blitzkrieg and knew that if they failed to act, if the West was failed to prepare for that, that there would be another world war and the odds were very great that we might lose it. Unfortunately, Churchill failed. Even Winston Churchill, eloquent and brilliant as he was, and his advisors, they failed, you know, because the Western democracies, 99% of the elites, didn't even believe there would be another world war. They couldn't conceive that anyone, that even an Adolf Hitler, I mean, before the war actually happened, don't forget, guys like Neville Chamberlain thought that Adolf Hitler, you know, was a reasonable man and he could be reasoned with. You know, totalitarian states usually are, because they're military dictatorships, because power comes out of the barrel of a gun for them, and they're basically uncivil, barbaric societies, totalitarian states, where it is the rule of power, all right? They tend to be extremely paranoid, dysfunctionally paranoid, and so they see the threats surrounding them in the world as even greater than they really are. Therefore, countries like Russia and China and North Korea and Iran see threats where they don't exist, like from the United States. They actually think that we're morally no better than they are, and that we have some kind of conspiracy. Everything we do is a plan to try to undermine them and eventually conquer them. That's how they think, and that's how they see the world. Unfortunately, the Western democracies are concerned, like the United States, our psychological problem is just the opposite. We're dysfunctionally optimists. You know, we tend to think that the other side is just like us, that they think like us, that they don't want war, they want peace, they don't have any crazy designs to take over the world or defeat us. How could they possibly see us as a threat? Everything we do is calculated to try to prove to them that we're not a threat. Surely they understand that, right? Don't they see the history of the United States? We don't start wars. You know, we're the good guys. Don't they understand that? And we believe that in our bones. And our elites believe that in our bones. And so for that reason, we are usually taken by surprise. And that's why we were taken by surprise by the Nazis in 1939, when they finally sprang the Blitzkrieg on the world. And they did nearly conquer Western civilization. And the only reason they didn't is we had to learn how to fight a better Blitzkrieg in the deserts of North Africa and on the plains of Eastern Europe in Russia. And it cost the Russians 20 million lives. Fortunately, it cost us only hundreds of thousands of lives. I say only with quotes around that. But it cost us big time in blood and treasure to defeat the Nazi Blitzkrieg. I'm afraid the next time won't be like that. You know, if we get hit with an EMP, it could be the end of our civilization in 24 hours, and there'd be no coming back from it. The lesson of World War II and the Cold War, you know, 100 million lives were lost in World War II and the Cold War. The lesson from that should be we can't afford to get taken by surprise again. And that's why I'm on your radio show today. And that's why I'm going on to Texas tomorrow and to Louisiana after that and Alabama after that, talking to anybody who will listen, because I don't know what else I can do but to reach out to your audience and try to educate people. And if the government won't act in time, then at least perhaps individual families can act in time. Since I was one of a handful of people who learning about this when I worked at the CIA, you know, for 10 years when I was a CIA analyst, I was their expert on EMP. And back then, all of this was deeply classified. You couldn't talk about it in public. And the stuff we're talking about today was not available to the public. It was only due to the heroic efforts of Dr. Graham, the free world's foremost expert in EMP, when he published our reports in 2004 and 2008. He said, no, the people have got to know, the industry has to know, the consequences of an EMP can't be limited to just, you know, a handful of people in the government. You know, we'll never get the country protected that way. So I fear you're right, too. I mean, every day, this is not a pleasant cross to carry. You know, it's a sometimes I wish I was never trained as a historian, because if you look at how this country and how Western democracies in the past have almost always failed to see the threat and failed to be prepared, it seems almost inevitable that I should conclude that I'm going to fail too. And so what should I do? Just give up and not try? I think like Churchill, I think Dr. Graham had a plaque on his wall, and it was a quote from Winston Churchill, and it said, never, 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 never give up. So I'm never going to give up. I'm going to try. I'm going to talk to as many people as I can. I think it is starting to make a difference. You know, at least some of the states are moving. We have had legislation starting to pass through Washington, but I don't want to give false hope to your audience either and exaggerate the rate of preparedness. I don't think the rate of our preparedness is keeping pace with the rate of the threat. When North Korean satellites are orbiting overhead, we still haven't protected the whole country. That's really bad news. And right now in the White House, you know, we have a leadership that wants to think that climate change is the biggest threat to our civilization and is in denial about almost daily nuclear threats coming out of North Korea. This is really bad. I mean, we've got the Neville Chamberlain of our time sitting in the White House. Anyway, that's my reaction to your remark. I share your lack of optimism, but what choice do I have? I think I've got to try, and so I keep trying.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And it seems to me that perhaps the best thing that could happen would be some type of natural EMP caused by the sun on a smaller scale to disrupt our electronic infrastructure to the point where it wouldn't cause widespread devastation, but enough to kind of bring about a wake-up call to not just the U.S., but to governments around the world. To me, that seems like the best-case scenario.
Well, you know, we already had that happen in 1989 during the Hydro-Quebec storm. I mean, blacking out half of Canada from a geomagnetic storm. You know, it wasn't a geomagnetic superstorm. It was a run-of-the-mill storm that happened to hit at a lower latitude, and it blacked out half of Canada. It even affected parts of the United States. We lost a big EHV transformer. It melted an EHV transformer in seconds. This transformer was designed to carry 750,000 volts, and it melted it in seconds. I mean, why isn't that a wake-up call? You know, but now I'm arguing the other side of the question. It should have been a wake-up call. It's amazing to me. I have a good friend, Vice Admiral Robert Monroe, who had been the director of the Defense Nuclear Agency. We were talking about this. What is it going to take to wake people up? And I remember Vice Admiral Monroe said he thought that 2013, when the North Koreans did their nuclear test in 2013 and launched that first satellite, he thought this will wake them up, you know? And logically, he should have been right, but it didn't. Now we've got a second satellite, and they've done another nuclear test, and they've threatened a fifth nuclear test. And still there's not the sense of urgency. But I do hope something will wake them up. Maybe a movie. I don't know. All these young people that are concerned about climate change, I think that their information is not coming from data, but it seems to be coming from the entertainment industry that has gotten them so spun up about something that is, you know, frankly, not well-founded scientifically. But let me say this to your audience on the issue of climate change. You know, I'm not a climatologist, though, right? And I'm agnostic on the question of climate change. I'm willing to entertain the possibility that Al Gore and these other people are right. But they have got an obligation to do what we did in the Congressional EMP Commission. You know, the way our society works is, you know, we don't base our public policy on what the United Nations tells us is true about science. You know, that's not the job of the United Nations, and it's not the job of our policymakers here in this country to listen to the United Nations. What you're supposed to have done is formed a presidential commission or a congressional commission and get the best climate scientists in the free world on that commission and have them fight it out over the data. When there is a presidential commission or congressional commission, a bipartisan one, all right, that is willing to listen to all the facts and hear all the point of view and give the kind of scrutiny to the scientific question that was given the EMP, then I will believe it if they come back and say, oh, yes, climate change is real. That's how our system works. That's why you have commissions. That's the role of them. But that hasn't happened, amazingly, even though we're actually making public policy, you know, based on the assumption that climate change is true, when actually there's quite a lot of evidence that it isn't. But anyway, that's another reason to not be very hopeful, I suppose, you know, because the facts don't seem to matter very much in this new world that we're in, where people don't get their information from reading anymore. They get it from the movies. They get it from their entertainments. I guess they get it from their friends. I got to switch tracks here because I usually would like to more optimistic about these things. I want to encourage people. People should become part of the solutions themselves. I think the thing is, you know, to get angry. Call them, your senator and congressman. Make them do their jobs. Make them protect your family. Do the same thing to your governor and your state legislature. Get angry and let them know you're angry about the fact that they haven't done anything in your state yet. Tell them to follow the examples of Maine and Virginia and Florida and Arizona, where people are starting to act. And last but not least, of course, undertake preparations yourself to ensure that your family and your community will be prepared.
We've been speaking with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He is the Executive Director of the Congressional EMP Commission and also the author of Blackout Wars. Dr. Pry, it was a pleasure having you on our show and speaking with you about the threat of EMPs at such an in-depth level, and I want to thank you for the generosity of your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and by having me, you have become part of the solution. So thank you for that, too.
So if you listen closely to this interview, I think you'd come away with the understanding that it's not a question of if, but when we're going to actually see an electromagnetic pulse occur, whether that is man-made or if it's natural. As he said, there's three different ways we can see an EMP generated. That could be through a coronal mass ejection, which we have seen in the past. And the last one that we saw of a fairly large size occurred in 1859, and that was called the Carrington event. And I believe he said that that actually disrupted the first transatlantic cable that was laid down and telegraph lines. And of course, you know, we were hardly dependent at that time on electric power or on communications at that point. So the devastation of a coronal mass ejection today would be much, much, much worse. And then he said, you know, of course, there's nuclear powered EMPs, and then the third being radio frequency EMPs, which could be easily carried out across different substations and cause our electric grid to go down nationwide. So the threat of an EMP is definitely being taken seriously. As he noted, there have been steps in that direction more recently because of North Korea, which has even used, he said, an electromagnetic cannon against South Korea. We have North Korean satellites that are orbiting at the right trajectory over the U.S. We've also seen a number of other incidents as well. And so there is some impetus in that direction. I guess the greatest fear, once again, is that governments are typically reactive and not proactive and are unlikely to take this threat seriously until we see some type of event occur. And as I noted at the end, it seems to me that the best case scenario is that we do see some type of natural EMP. I don't want to wish that we have an EMP of any type, but if we are to see more push in this direction from the public in terms of a public outcry, or even in terms of governments and corporations, taking just small steps, like he said, you know, whether or not that's even putting a wire mesh around cables in cars, if car manufacturers were just to do that by default, you know, that would protect your car from an EMP. So there's a number of things that could be done that won't be, because people underestimate the probability of an EMP occurring since we haven't seen one for so long. And as he noted, we are definitely due for one from the sun. And so a small EMP attack of some sort would probably be the best case scenario to really move things in that direction. Once again, I'm not wishing that type of event, but given the events that he described and kind of the situation that we're facing, perhaps that is the best case scenario. If you want to read more about electromagnetic pulses and get into depth beyond this interview itself, you can certainly order his book, Blackout Wars. We'll have a link to that where this interview is located on Amazon, and I'll also have a number of other links that may be of interest to you if you want to research this more thoroughly. And last but not least, I think it's safe to say that this is an issue that we should feel strongly about and research more and do our part to notify those in power and those who have the ability to make changes and protect us from the risk of an EMP. I'm Chris Sheridan. You're listening to FS Insider at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is author Ken Fisher. His new book is called Beat the Crowd, how you can outvest the herd by thinking differently. Ken, in your book, you talk about contrary thinking has been a theme that has run throughout many of your books that you have written, but you never overtly addressed it. So in this book, you wanted to address the issue. In your opinion, it's more about independent thinking. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. When I was young a long time ago in a world far, far away, contrarianism was generally thought of then as try to figure out what the crowd's thinking and think that the reverse will happen. In theory, what should happen is what consensus agrees on should be priced into markets and therefore should not occur. But beyond that, theoretically, anything could happen. And the traditional notion of contrarianism seems to me in this day and age to be flat wrong, because it's easier and easier and easier to see the consensus through the internet, to see what people tend to agree on, to be able to build up consensus metrics. And therefore, today there's always the herd, and then there's what I call the anti-herd herd, or the folks that are set up to be the reverse of the herd. So there's really two herds.
Welcome back again to the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up next, in-depth conversation with both Chris Sheridan and Chris Paplava on the detailed outlook for the U.S. economy, examining current trends and growing signs for a major market top this year. And of course, there's always the discussion of a recession. Okay, Chris Sheridan.
Joining us on the show today is Chris Paplava. He's the Chief Investment Officer at PFS Group, and he's also a regular contributor to Financial Sense. When we had spoken to you in the past, we discussed that a lot of experts, including yourself, were looking at a peak in the credit markets, that credit spreads were as low as they were probably going to get, and that the cost of debt was going to continue to rise in the future. This was a point that was being made by Jeff Gundlach, and you'd also talked about how the economic growth in U.S. was likely the best that we would see, and that going forward, it was going to be deteriorating. And I believe you had also spoken of the idea that we are in the late stage of an economic cycle. So I believe that is a brief summary of some of the things that you had said in prior broadcasts. Why don't you catch our listeners up to speed and tell us where you think things are currently?
Well, I think part of the issue that we were facing was a slowing global economy. And that was a backdrop that Janet Yellen was trying to raise rates in. And it just exacerbated the problem where, you know, the Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank continued to have easy monetary policy, but then you see what the U.S. Fed was doing was contrary to that. And given how much in dollar-denominated debt has been issued abroad, that clearly was putting strains on the global community with the rise in the dollar. And then that ultimately spilled over into the energy sector here domestically and was hurting our manufacturing base. And so the Fed is great at putting fires out. They're not great at seeing them before they start. And that's what happened. I mean, China devalued their currency. The market sold off in January. Credit spreads were blowing up. Oil was heading down into the 20s. Obviously, Janet realized that she was adding fuel to the fire by causing the dollar to go up even higher by raising rates. So she dialed back the Fed's rhetoric, and the number of rate hikes that were projected for this year continued to fall. And that then led to a correction in the dollar and a recovery elsewhere. Now, it's very easy to look at the market swinging one way or the other. I mean, back in January, February, everyone thought the world was coming to an end and every technician was bearish. A lot of strategists were calling for a recession. From my vantage point, I did think in the last time we spoke, I said the best was behind us in terms of the U.S. economy. Well, just because the best is behind you doesn't mean you're still growing. I was making the case that we were decelerating, that we were going to have slower and slower growth. And you can look at the Atlanta Fed's GDP nowcast for Q1, and it's basically just above zero. So I still feel we're decelerating. But things got a little too bearish, and things got a little bit too extreme, and the market's come all the way back to its former highs. Now the question is, does that mean it was just a blip on the bull market radar, and things are heading higher, or are things still a little bit dicey out there? To do that, to filter out the noise, I try to step back a little bit and look at the various sectors of the economy. Are they improving or deteriorating? And, you know, really try to assess where we are in the business cycle, because where you are in the business cycle, whether you're in the early phase, the mid phase, the late phase, or outright recession, it really affects what market returns are and how much return you get per unit of risk that you're taking. And in the early phase, you want to take risk because you're rewarded for it with returns. And in the latter phase, you don't want to take risk because you're not rewarded. You're taking one unit of risk for every one unit of return you're getting versus in the beginning, you might have 5 units of return for every one unit of risk. And what I've seen just confirms to me that the best of the economy is behind us. I continually watch the incoming data that comes out. And one of the things I was noticing was that one of the strong areas of the economy looks like it may be sputtering, and that's housing. If you look at the National Association of Home Builders Market Index, which is essentially a leading economic indicator for housing, it's been rolling over recently. Over the last quarter, we've had a pretty consecutive strain of declines in that index. The other thing I've been looking to that generally tracks the housing market index is housing starts relative to housing completion. If you think about it, if you just started building a home, you've got a long ways ahead of paying for the workers to build that home, all the labor, then all the building materials that go involved in purchases to build the home. And then once the home is built, then think of the other knock-on effects of putting in a washer and dryer, putting in a water heater, putting in a refrigerator, basically durable goods orders. So watching housing, it really does have so many ripple effects in the economy. And so if you see a lot of starts relative to completion, so once a home's complete, essentially the stimulus from that home begins to wane. And so that's why I like to look at housing starts early part of the cycle versus completion. And that ratio tends to track the housing market index. And what I'm noticing is that housing starts are not keeping pace with completion. I'm starting to see a peak in that ratio. And we saw that just prior to the last recession. And you often say it before recessions in general, but that has been trending down. And that supports the notion that housing starts aren't moving up as rapidly and completions are picking up the pace as housing starts haven't kept up with them. And so that tends to tell me that housing is beginning to slow down.
And just for our listeners' reference, if any of you want to follow along and look at these charts that Chris is going to be mentioning, because we're going to be going through a number of them, a lot of times it'll be helpful to kind of look at these trends as they've developed over prior decades. Some of these charts go back to the 1950s, so you can see for yourself exactly what Chris is going to be mentioning here. So you can locate those at the Financial Sense website. Many of these you'll be familiar with if you've been a longtime reader of the site, because we do regular updates on these. Go ahead and click the link where these charts are located. You can see exactly what Chris is saying. So, Chris, just to repeat, you're looking at a peak in the total starts to housing completions index, and that appears to be falling, and that tracks the NAHB, the National Association of Home Builders Index, fairly closely. And so you believe that that shows a deceleration in the U.S. economy, given that housing is such a large contribution to GDP.
That's correct. And if you really want to know how strong the economy is, the easiest thing to do is to look at the most cyclical areas of the economy, areas that you see the boom-bust cycles in, looking at grocery store sales or how much people are spending on household products. You know, you're going to have to spend that whether you're in a recession or not. So that's not very helpful. But looking at housing activity, looking at auto production, these are things that are extremely cyclical. A lot of it has to do with manufacturing. And whether manufacturing is contracting or expanding can really tell you a lot about the economy and its growth rate. Outside of housing, one of the strong areas of this economic expansion has been auto production and auto sales. Auto sales, since the recession ended in 2009, have had a very strong and consistent upward trend of accelerating from 10 million units back in 2009 to the present of 18 million units, and we're moving back down. If you look at where we are right now, and this is something that does concern me because we have had a few volatile months, you know, where we might have a short-term spike down or spike up, but the general trend's been clearly up. What looks like to me is a trend change in auto production. We've clearly rolled over, and we've had, I think, maybe one rising month since mid-2015, and it looks like a top. So if housing is stalling, if auto sales and production are stalling, I think that does not bode well for the U.S. economy for the rest of the year, given how cyclical they are, and that these have been some of the strongest areas of the economy. There's other things that I look at that tend to have me even further concerned that we are in this slow decline from positive growth towards negative growth. One of them being the trend in temporary employment. And I may have given this analogy or explanation before in a prior interview, but I think it's worthwhile to go into it again. When you're a business and you see your corporate profit margins begin to peak, you have to protect your bottom line. And you have to figure out, how can I protect my net income? And one of the ways you do that is when you look at your labor, which is typically your biggest cost. The first thing you're going to do is you're going to lay off temporary employment workers. These are workers that you're not going to have to pay unemployment claims or any bonus when you let them go. And so they are the least costly worker to let go. After you've gone through your temp workers, the next thing you're going to do is stop hiring. And then ultimately, the last step in the labor cycle is you're going to start having layoffs. And one of the things I'm doing is I'm looking at temporary employment and its growth rate annually relative to the growth rate of the economy. And often at times, you see that temporary employment turns negative prior to overall employment turn negative. And if you look at the last two cycles, to give you an example, the employment for national payrolls did not turn negative until the middle of the 2001 recession. Temporary employment, however, went negative late 2000, early 2001, before the recession. If you look at the December 2007 through June 2009 recession, temporary employment was negative, I believe, somewhere in 2006. And it was negative well before overall employment, which didn't turn negative until 2008, when we were already in a recession. So, you know, I know some people have looked at the payrolls recently and said they've been pretty strong, but if you go below the surface, that's not the case. If you look at temp employment right now, it's been growing about 2.1% year over year. However, if you look at where it was about a year ago, we were growing around 6-7% annually. Prior to that, we're at that growth rate for much of the expansion over the last 3 years or so. And if you look at where we are and how it's been trending, it's conceivable that we can have negative temporary employment growth by this summer. And I recently read a comment from 75-year-old Bob Funk. He is the CEO of Express Employment Professionals, which provides temporary workers to companies. He said, "I'm a little concerned. Our industry is always on the front end of a recession, as provisional workers are the first to be let go on signs of economic weakness." He's currently concerned based on what he's seeing in the market.
So, Chris, you made a really important point, because a lot of people will say, you know, if you look at the non-farm payrolls, they're pretty strong. It doesn't show that there's any signs of economic weakness. But as you noted, non-farm payrolls, they tend to contract while you're in the middle of recession. So they're not a leading indicator of recession. They will tend to top out and start to weaken before a recession, but we don't actually start to see contraction until you're into a recession. And as you said, temp services, temp employment, will contract prior to a recession. So it's a little bit more of an early warning indicator. And currently, if you look at the chart, like you said, it's definitely decelerated. It's getting closer to that point of contracting. We're not quite there yet. So perhaps there's not a red flag being raised from temp employment in terms of an imminent recession that is months or a quarter or two away. But it does definitely show that the U.S. economy, according to that measure, and as you mentioned with housing and now also auto production, is decelerating. So that's kind of the message given so far from these charts that you're mentioning.
That's correct. And there's another indicator coming from the Kansas City. They have two things. They look at labor momentum, and they look at the general level of employment. And so they have a labor market conditions index and a labor market conditions momentum index. And both of those have clearly rolled over, and they've been in a declining trend since 2015. So this confirms the message that we're seeing in the temporary employment data. Given how significant labor is for any economy, that's a clear warning sign that right now, yes, we're adding 200 to 225,000 jobs per month, but given the deterioration in temp employment, it's only time when you start to see CEOs slow down hiring of their normal labor force. That's something, along with slowing housing, along with slowing auto production, does give me concern. When I look at the leading economic indicators, it's no surprise, given those big areas of the economy are weakening, that the LAIs themselves are showing some weakness. To give you an example of that, all of our Federal Reserve districts, they've got great research departments from people that work there. And I just mentioned the labor data coming from the Kansas City Fed. One of the ones I really like is the Philadelphia Fed. A lot of people just look at national data, which can be helpful. But again, I think breaking out the data and looking at beneath the surface of what the level or how we get to that level is really important. And that's what the Philadelphia Fed does, is they look at state data. So we're looking at all 50 states, not just whatever the national level is. And one of the things they do is to look at how many states are growing, how many are contracting. Typically, you can almost bookend recessions by this indicator, which is why I really track it closely. What I'm looking for typically is when an equal number of our states are growing with states that are contracting, that's typically when a recession begins. It's also typically when a recession ends. And so what I'm doing is I'm looking at how many states are growing. And as early as late 2014, 100% of the states across our nation were growing. And during a typical expansion, that oscillates between 80 and 100%. You can have low growth scares like the mid-cycle growth slowdown in the 80s or 90s, where you got down to maybe even 70%. But by and large, you're going to oscillate between 80 and 20% of the country expanding. And as I mentioned to you, we were at 100% at the end of 2014. Throughout 2015, that plummeted to 70%. We did see some improvement late in the year, but that's subsequently been given back. And we're now at 68%. And that is the lowest level we've seen since 2010, 2011, when the economy was accelerating and we were going from 0 to 20 to 50, 75 to 100%. Expansion across our states. So that's a clear negative trend that I'm watching that does bear some concern that we are starting that phase. We're now in late cycle and we're moving closer and closer to recession. Similar to that is the Conference Board's Coincident Diffusion Index. So they have a whole bunch of leading economic indicators, and what they're looking at is how many are rising, how many are falling. And it's bounded by zero, which means every indicator is falling. And it's bounded by 100, meaning we have 100% growth in those indicators. And like the Philly Fed State Coincident Index, typically during economic expansion, you're seeing anywhere from 80 to 100% of the time the indicators are expanding. Right now, we're at 75%. And again, as early as the middle of 2015, we were at 100%. And we have had month after month after month of declines, such that we are now at the lowest point since coming out of the recession. What I've seen is we can have a few false signals where we get down to as low as 60% or 65%, but once you go below 60, I haven't seen any false signals that don't lead to recession. And so that's why I'm watching that closely and why I also think it is time to get defensive. That was the message I gave last month, and it's still the message that I have now, is that given the deterioration in the economy, I still think it makes a lot of sense to play defense.
So we touched on housing, we touched on auto sales, also temporary employment, a lot of the leading economic indicators coming out of the Philly Fed, and even the Conference Board. When you put all that together, what do you see as the risks of recession this year or next year? Give us an idea. Are you looking at an imminent recession, or do you think that that's going to occur months out? How do you put all that together?
Well, you know, I've said this before, and I think it really visually makes a lot of sense. When you're dealing with the size of the U.S. economy, which is well over $10 trillion, I think we're somewhere between 14 and 16 trillion, I don't know the exact number, that's a big economy. The U.S. economy does not turn on a dime. Anyone who says they did not see the recession coming, what that tells me is they're not looking at the data, and they kind of have a myopic focus that everything's rosy, and they just exclude the negative data. What I mean by that is if you look at an oil tanker, something with a huge, massive size to it, it will not turn on a dime. It takes a long time for an oil tanker to do a 180 and to make a broad, abrupt turn. And it's the same thing with the U.S. economy. You're not going to go from strong economic growth to zero and then outright negative growth. It's going to be a process where you slowly and surely deteriorate. The way I measure that is by looking at growth, growth in consumption, growth in employment, growth in production. And if you just see these things go from a 2% to a 3, 4, 5% growth, and then you start to see it flatten and it stalls at 5%, and then you're seeing the other side of the hill where it's now going from 5 to 4 to 3 to 2. And if you look at the trajectory and the rate of deceleration, you can kind of pinpoint some targets of where you think it will actually hit negative growth. And that's what I was talking about earlier, looking at temporary employment. Temporary employment typically grows in the mid to high single digits, and we've been decelerating for some time now. And if we continue that path of deceleration, I think we could have negative temporary employment growth as early as this summer, which would mean we would be in negative territory by the second half of this year, which would probably coincide with flat national overall annual growth. And so when I look at everything, it does tell me that we are on that downward slope. We're going down the hill. And that's why the best days are behind us, and what I said in our last interview. My own model that I created, it's a very simplistic model. I have several inputs that go into it. But I'm looking at the probability of a recession in the near term. And currently right now, my model is at 19.5% probability of a recession. That is the highest rate probability that I've seen since the recession ended. And typically for me, anything below 20% is noise. So this is still noise to me. We did see somewhere around 18-17% in 2011, and then it came back down. But that doesn't mean my eyebrows aren't raised. We've only had one false signal since the late 70s where it went above 20% and didn't lead to recession, and that was 1989. We hit about 30%, went back down to 15%, and then we went all the way up to over 80% as the recession began in 1991. Currently, right now, we're at 19.5%. It does cause me to have some concern. But again, back to the whole idea that the economy doesn't turn on a dime. My personal belief, given everything that I'm looking at, unless there's some major outside force like monetary and fiscal stimulus that can give some life to the economy, if we continue on our current rate and path, I believe we'll be in a recession by mid to late next year. Typically, the market anticipates that 6 to 9 months in advance. So that would target a potential market top sometime late this year. You look at last year, we had a flat market. I think we could have another flat market where we're up 10%, down 10%, up and down. And that's essentially what we've had since mid-2015. We've had just a sideways market with not a lot of movement forward. Given the deceleration in the economy, it's not too surprising to me that we're starting to see some deterioration in the credit markets, which is confirming the message of the economy. And that's why I think looking at the credit markets in conjunction with the economy does shed some light that we are in the later phase of this economy.
Chris, one thing in particular that we've been addressing and talking about on Financial Sense NewsHour is the percent of banks tightening. It appears that banks have tightened considerably from their lows. That is, banks were quite easy in their lending standards, or the easiest they were, in around, I believe it was 2014, 2013 is when it looks like that had peaked. And they have been tightening ever since. And now I believe we're at the tightest we've been this whole cycle. Tell us a little bit about that and how you see that influencing payroll growth and the overall U.S. economy.
Sure. I always like to look for trends and things and how they correlate. And one of the indicators I think has the strongest correlation to national employment growth is what banks are doing in terms of lending standards to small commercial industrial loans for small firms. So essentially, this is what banks are doing to small businesses, and small businesses are the heart and soul of this country in terms of employment. If you look at what banks are doing, when banks ease lending standards and makes credit easier for small firms to obtain, they then take that credit and they invest it in their business and they expand employment, they expand their facilities and so forth. So that tends to lead to job growth and overall economic activity. Now, when banks start to close their doors in terms of not issuing new loans or making it more difficult to issue loans to small businesses, that's essentially closing the purse string. And it's kind of like your parents taking away the cookie jar or, you know, taking away their purse. It's going to lead to some trouble down the line. As I mentioned, even Jeff Gundlach mentioned in 2014 is when the credit markets peaked. Interestingly, in mid part of 2014, that was when things got the easiest for small businesses, when roughly a net 15% of banks were easing standards for small businesses. We are now a net zero, meaning roughly an equal amount of banks are tightening as well as a number of equal banks are easing. And remember what I mentioned about looking at the Philly Fed state data? We tend to be in trouble when an equal number are expanding versus contracting. It's somewhat similar to bank lending standards to small firms. You're kind of at that tipping point of bearish views versus bullish views. This tends to lead employment growth by around 3 months or so. And this suggests to me that payroll growth in the U.S. does begin to slow this summer and may even turn outright negative by this fall to winter. And that's why I think now is the time to get defensive. That's confirming to me that the credit markets are singing the same tune as the labor markets. Now, there's other things that tell me that credit market has peaked. One of them is the Atlanta Fed's shadow Fed funds rate. And what they're doing is they're trying to look at monetary policy, what the Fed's doing with QE and other stimulative measures, and trying to condense that all to what would be the equivalent impact if it was expressed as an interest rate. At the peak in the credit markets in 2014, it was saying that the real rate of the shadow Fed funds rate for the U.S. was negative 3%. Even before Yellen raised the Fed funds rate in December, the Fed's shadow funds rate went from negative 3 to 0, meaning we saw a 300 basis point movement in monetary policy in the U.S. before the Fed even raised actual rates by taking away QE3, QE4 through the taper. At the same time, we were also seeing global liquidity begin to contract. And I measure that by looking at the total global international reserve assets. Now, a large part of that was China selling its foreign currency reserves to defend its currency. But other parts of the globe were also beginning to shed their international reserve assets. So we had a U.S. Fed that was tightening by removing QE, and we had global liquidity falling by looking at reserve currency assets. And all of that was occurring right when the S&P began to stall late 2014, early 2015. That trend has not changed. If you look at international reserve assets, it's still in a downward trend since 2014. Something along those lines is looking at the B of A's Merrill Lynch Global Liquidity Tracker, which I know it's been mentioned on our website and on the air. That's still in negative territory, and it's expressed in terms of standard deviation. So normal times, you're going to be at zero. Positive one means you're at a one standard deviation event. Negative one means you're at a negative one standard deviation event. We're at negative 1.5. So that's about as tight as liquidity was falling out of the system back in 2011 when we had a mini bear market. Unlike the rally out of 2011 into 2012, when global liquidity was moving from a negative 1.5, two standard deviation event to positive, we haven't really seen any improvement in the global liquidity tracker from B of A. So that tells me that you still have international assets receding. And it's kind of like that quote, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. Well, we have the opposite. A falling tide sinks all ships. That's why I still have some reservations about chasing the market higher here, given liquidity is not moving into the system. When you look at total foreign currency reserves, you're looking at B of A's liquidity tracker, or even what the Fed shadow funds rate is doing, it's not painting a rosy picture. That's also somewhat reflected in the Bloomberg U.S. Financial Conditions Index, which looks at a lot of credit spreads. We are at positive territory, but if you look at it, the peak was in 2014, and we've had a consistent negative trend of lower highs since that point. And so I would have to see it move 10%, 20% higher to tell me that we might actually be in an improving environment in terms of financial conditions in the U.S. rather than just having a short-term improvement. One thing I found was interesting was the credit markets began to deteriorate in the U.S. significantly mid-late 2015. By that, I'm measuring the TED spread, the LIBOR OIS spread, and both of those were really moving up in the latter part of 2015. They shot up January 2016, and they have improved with the rally since the February lows. However, recently, the TED spread has begun to deteriorate again, and the LIBOR OIS spread is still near its highs. So measuring those two credit measures of financial stress, we are still at the highest levels in those measures since 2012. So I do not think it's a green light that everything's gone back to normal when looking at the economy. One thing that a lot of people have mentioned or, you know, look at is the Citigroup's Economic Surprise Index. What this index measures is the percentage of economic releases that come out that beat consensus estimates. So a zero means you're an equal number beat estimates versus those that fail to beat estimates. Typically, the S&P rallies when the economy is improving, when things are coming out better than expected. And often at times, we tend to see corrections when the economic reports coming out are worse than expected. Beginning in 2015, the Citigroup Economic Surprise Index for the U.S. economy turned negative. Right now, we have the longest string of negative readings throughout this entire economic expansion. Even when we started to improve in 2015 and 2016, the best we could reach was neutral. You go back every single rally that we've had in the last 6 years after a correction, Citigroup Economic Surprise Index has always gone back into positive territory. That is not the case today. The summer rally in the S&P and improvement in the economy did not exceed zero. The rally we had going from the summer lows into November did not exceed 0%. And then we had the sell-off in January, February. The best we did recently was we hit zero. We're already back at a negative 23%, meaning a net 23% of economic releases are surprising to the downside. So that's concern for me, that we're not, in a sense, having escape velocity on many spurts of economic improvement in the economy.
As you mentioned, the economy is not really surprising to the upside, and we can see that with the Citigroup Economic Surprise Index. It's definitely negative, and it has been below zero for quite some time now. And that coincides with the topping out of the market that we've seen so far. Previously, you did say that you're looking at a recession probably around mid to late 2017, and then that would put the timing of a market top possibly around later this year in 2016. What about valuations? Because this is a topic that's been raised many times on our show. Technicians will often bring up valuation arguments either for or against investing in the stock market at current levels. When you look at valuations, and you have a chart here that you show of household net worth, explain that to our listeners and why you think that this is also giving a concerning message.
Sure. You know, one of the things that a lot of people do, some big value investors like Warren Buffett, Jeremy Grantham, some really solid economists like Dave Rosenberg, is you look at a ratio and you look at it going back decades and decades of history, and you want to figure out, is this a statistical extreme? Does this make sense looking back at history? Is this sustainable? One of the things that was a major red light to even Robert Shiller, the famous economist who wrote the book back in the 90s, Irrational Exuberance, one of the things he warned about in the 2000s was the housing bubble. He was very clear when he was on CNBC and other financial media that we had a housing bubble and it would not end well. A lot of people would come back to him and say, well, you know, we've never had housing prices decline nationally. And, you know, the same stuff that everyone was parroting. He says, look, all I know is we're at a bubble and you can try to deflect that like many people did with the tech bubble, or you can step back and say, you know what, there's a lot of risk here. What he looked at, and he had data going back to the Great Depression, was the median housing price divided by the median income. Now, it would make sense that as your incomes rise, you can afford a more expensive home and vice versa. But the price and appreciation of homes was so far above the growth in income that it was not sustainable, and it was only made possible by cheap and easy money. And just as the banks can turn on the spigot of credit, they can turn it off. And once it began to turn off in late 2007, it was turned off and things abruptly corrected. And we were at a 4-standard deviation event, which is a very statistical extreme in terms of housing prices to income. Well, I've kind of done something similar looking at what I call Wall Street versus Main Street. And what I'm looking at is household net worth, which is their financial assets relative to their income. And it's very similar to housing prices relative to household income. They relatively should be in alignment. Whenever you have a significant contraction in household net worth relative to income, that's typically more showing a point of value in financial assets and vice versa. And looking at that ratio, and we'll have it up on the website, I'm going back to World War II. I'm going back to the 40s, 1940. Where we are right now is exactly where we were, or if not a little bit higher than the peak we saw in 2007 during the housing boom. And that peak in 2007 was a bigger peak than what we saw in the tech bubble of 2000. Now, a lot of people need to understand that not everyone owns a stock portfolio. Some people literally live paycheck to paycheck. So a stock bubble does not affect everyone across the economy. However, housing is much more broad-based. More people do own housing. They're involved in one form or another. And so that's why the bubble we saw in 2007 was bigger than the bubble in 2000, meaning like a total household wealth, given housing was a bigger part of the economy than the stock market. And as I mentioned, we are all the way back to the 2007 bubble levels. And we are so far above where we were in 2009 or in 2003. So, in my opinion, the growth in the financial economy in our bond portfolios, our stock portfolios, our real estate, homeowner equity, it is so far above what's happened in Main Street in terms of incomes that to me it looks like a bubble that is not sustainable. And that gives me pause. So we have a slowing economy and we have inflated financial assets. Thank you, Fed, with all the money printing, the low interest rates with people propping up valuations and financial assets. It gives me a great level of concern. Another measure that confirms that, which is called the Buffett Indicator, it's looking at corporate equity value relative to the economy, or GDP. Recently, we have started to come off with the correction, but overall, we are higher than we were in 2007, but not quite as nutty as it was in 2000. But again, this is only looking at corporate equity value. And that's why I like my measure of household net worth, because that looks at financial assets across the board, not just the stock market. And we're at bubble levels when you look at relative to something like the economy. So again, these things give me concern and give me pause that as an investor, you have to ask yourself, how much risk are you taking to squeeze out that last bit of return? Is the valuation there for the assets that you're buying? If they aren't, then the best thing to do is to play defense and wait for the value to appear. And that, to me, is what makes the most sense, given we have a decelerated economy, a tightening credit market, and a bubble in Wall Street versus Main Street. So all of these things do not have me wanting to chase this market near all-time highs. If anything, now is the time, I think, to get a little bit defensive, take advantage of this rally, and sell some of your riskier assets.
So you cited a few different really important key points there. The economy is slowing. When we look at some of these measures that you just cited, it definitely appears that financial assets are inflated. By some metrics, they appear to be at bubble-like levels. That being said, are you looking at, I know you said that we might see a market peak later this year, 2016, if these trends continue as they are currently. When it comes to another financial market collapse or crash, do you think it's going to be to the same magnitude as what we saw after 2007 with the great financial crisis? Do you think that assets are at such bubble-like levels that it means the unwind is going to be as severe? What are your thoughts there?
I think I said this in our last interview. I do not feel that we were at a bubble in the economy because I don't see a lot of excesses. We had a lot of excess in terms of energy investment, and we've largely washed that out. If you look at industrial production, you look at auto production, housing starts, we're literally right back to the long-term mean. So for us to peak at this level, we didn't even get as high as prior peaks. So I don't see a significant downturn in the economy like what we saw in 2007, 2008. But I do think it will be more of a typical garden variety correction in the economy. However, I think we have a lot of excess of speculation in the financial market. So I do think we could have a considerable decline in financial assets as we bring back the long-term ratios that I was mentioning earlier of financial assets to household income. I do think there's a lot of excesses to be run out of the financial system. But economically speaking, I'm calling for a garden variety recession, not a severe one like we saw in the last recession. But again, given where valuations are stretched, I do think there is a considerable amount of weakness or potential weakness in the financial market.
Once again, we've been speaking with Chris Poplavi. He's the Chief Investment Officer at PFS Group, as well as a regular contributor to Financial Sense. And all of the charts and data that we've been discussing today, you can find where this interview is located. We'll have it posted there. And Chris, if there's any way in which our listeners wanted to get a hold of more of your work or to speak with you, what would be the best way to do so?
They can send me an email at cpuplava, that's P-U-P-L-A-V-A, at puplava.com.
Chris, it was a pleasure speaking to you on FS Insider, and we hope to speak to you again in the future.
Thanks, Chris. Have a good day.
So I don't think there's much that can be added to that interview. Chris made it pretty clear. He's looking at the U.S. economy decelerating. Even with markets back close to their highs, he thinks we're looking at diminishing rates of return from current levels. And he noted the U.S. economy doesn't turn on a dime. It's certainly a process. And we are seeing a deceleration in a large number of very important metrics, whether or not that's housing, whether or not that's auto sales, whether or not that is the trend in the labor markets, which you can look at as well. which once again, you can refer to by looking at the charts that we mentioned that are posted. So he says, you know, recession mid to late next year if these trajectories continue, and a market top perhaps later this year. In terms of what would it take for Chris to change his mind, I think it's pretty clear. We need to see these measures reverse. We'd want to see temporary unemployment trough and start to pick back up, meaning that companies are taking on more temp workers in the face of growing economic growth. We'd want to see some of these leading economic indicators turn around, which they are currently starting to decelerate. And we'd certainly want to see bank tightening reverse. We'd want to see banks loosen up, as well as liquidity measures turn more positive. And as he noted, the B of A Merrill Lynch Global Liquidity Tracker is currently at a negative 1.5 standard deviation. That's about where we were in 2011, 2012. But it was also, if you go back further and if you look at the chart, it's also about where we were as the market peaked in 2007. We could be looking at a peaking process here, similar to 2007, or we could be at a place similar to 2011, 2012, when you look at the global liquidity tracker. The big question now is whether or not some of these trends are going to decelerate further and how they're going to continue. So these are going to be a lot of the things that we're going to be reporting on, both on our show and on our site.
Obviously, looking toward the possibility of a Fed rate hike, we've mentioned it here on the show today. It's going to be the ongoing conversation as we move into June or July, just like it was for last year. Many other things coming across our horizon where we will keep them under surveillance for future Financial Sense NewsHour programs. Jim Poplava was out this week. He'll be back again next week. And on behalf of the entire Financial Sense NewsHour staff, on behalf of Jim Poplava, I'm John Loeffler. Have a terrific weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.